Test.
When you get a chance, I want you to listen to it. Sorry, I should have told you before. Okay, well, depending on how many tapes we shoot, we can start with 13. If there are things that you'd like to elaborate on further or other things you'd like to bring up, please do. So we have a bunch of questions constructed here to touch on a lot of phases of work you've done. And talk about this a little bit. You made a statement in the other room just now when we were looking, you were talking about how you always been interested in the marriage of aerodynamics and automotive design, and that's that. I think that's the overall thing that we would really like to have you talk about. And then within that, telling us about certain specific and other general things that that you've done. And I don't know whether these questions cover all of the important things. You can let us know. Sure. So in general, it's unlike some types of interviews for magazines or for oral histories or things like that. It's the best thing is to make, whenever possible, to make a self-contained statement. That whoops.
Okay, now.
Because that.
Now, how about this note?
Because we'll be editing the material, so it's very helpful sometimes to actually begin what you're saying, you know, in a way that could be encapsulated as a self-contained statement. That's very helpful. But the important thing is to just feel comfortable and natural as you're talking.
Can you push it as close, point the nose farther?
A few last minute adjustments.
Yeah. Now I got the wheel. Okay. Yay. Ooh, my leg.
Okay, well, Mr. Tremulous, we have many questions here, but one of the things that we would like to have you tell us about is how you got started in transportation design.
I think I owe a lot of it to my father, and was an autoholic. The best way I can really describe interest got the automobile industry. It was on a Chicago afternoon. My father drove a Templar automobile, a 1940 model automobile. 6 inches of snow on the ground in Chicago. This particular car had absolutely no top, no doors, but it was an out and out sort of a race car. And he blew one of the three horns that he had. My mother came out, knowing that Dad had a new automobile. And she was absolutely horrified to see 6 inches of snow inside the car. And Dad said, just don't worry about it, Antoinette. See this little pail we have here? It's got a shovel and big screwdriver there. And the salesman was so nice. All this on the floor. Let me show you what we came up with. We had approximately 8 screws. And by taking 4 of the screws off, the right side and the left side, we lift up the 2 pieces of plywood, and all the snow is dumped on the pavement, and the stolen. And of course, my mother was very unhappy about this situation. But it was a beautiful automobile, and I took great pride in that car. And my father could do no wrong. He just loved automobiles. And, as a doctor, he enjoyed the ritual that as long as he had that doctor's insignia in the back, just as much as he wanted. And then from then and there, it was a piece of cake. Just loved drawing automobiles. Father used to make sketches of automobiles. I could never understand some of the philosophies, such as a four-passenger Fayetteville with the top down, hauling a big tree that it just didn't make any sense. It was a Christmas tree, which was a lot of pretty little. That was just a idea. But I caught on, and I loved automobiles, and I think one of the biggest breakthroughs was I was about 6 or 7 years old when I looked at the Sunday paper in Chicago, and there was a picture of three automobiles being on the road, and these three cars were very unusual. They were designed by a man called Paul Jarrett, who was an aerodynamicist. And I looked at these cars, and I thought, in my opinion, they were very beautiful. They were very high and very ungainly. But there was a philosophy there, where the four wheels were actually covered with sheet metal, and the windshield was absolutely round and came back to a very sharp teardrop. And they had a coefficient of drag. Of course, I didn't know this at those days, but history has decreed that these automobiles, the generated cars, were the lowest drag automobiles in the world. And I gazed at these cars for such a long time that when I got up, I could hardly walk because all the circulation was off my knees.
Would you tell us a little bit about the development of the Thunderbolt?
Oh, the Thunderbolt, yes. Oh, fine. That was a very interesting project. I remember at that time I was working at Briggs LeBaron. Briggs Body was the world's largest manufacturer of cars. They built all the Ford cars at that time. And the LeBaron bodies, of course, were specialized Lincoln bodies. They were usually built. In those days, when they ordered custom-built cars, they always ordered them in batches of 25 cars. And what had happened is that Ralph Roberts had come back from Ford of England because there was some war scare things on the horizon, especially in England. And Ralph Roberts came in. I always admired the man. He was one of the executives and creators of the LeBaron body. And he never admitted that he had talent as a designer, but I found out that he did have a lot of talent. And especially when he worked on the clay model. That's a three-dimensional, that's a moment of truth. When you go from paper to a clay model. And he at that time was sketching some scooters, and knowing what the British weather was like, he actually had a high windshield and side curtains that he could have to stay out of the rain. And I said, Ralph, I think you've been in England too long. Let's do something else. Like what? Well, I said, there's one thing I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to design an automobile that really inherited its styling. And inspired by the world's fastest cars that were driven by Sir Malcolm Campbell, John Cobb, Captain George Easton, these were very exciting automobiles. And I'd like to design a couple automobiles that inherit some of the qualities, such as let's pick some names. Let's start off with a Golden Arrow. This was Major Seagrave's beautiful 240-mile-an-hour Golden Arrow. And let's do George Easton's Thunderbolt. That Thunderbolt is something else. It's got six wheels on it for some reason or other. It has an enormous amount of horsepower. It's got two aircraft engines. They're developing about 5,000 horsepower. And it's one of the, they're all streamlined automobiles. And let's make a title such as the Measured Mile Creates a New Word. And with this new motor car, I think we'll call, we'll build two cars, a Golden Arrow, and I remember Ralph Talbot said, well, what kind of a car shall I do?
Whoops.
The Golden Arrow.
We have to just stop for a second because the, one of the things that's taped up just slid a little bit to make some noise. So. Some shades over them. That way.
A couple things. Give me a little bit of jacket. And I think I also want to take the microphone. Okay, here's the level.
So if you wanted to just pick up at the point where you were talking about developing those designs for those names.
Oh, yes. The reason I really did it was that in 1933, the Chrysler Airflow automobile made their debut at the New York Auto Show, the Chicago Auto Show. And this was the first approach to an aerodynamic production automobile. Now, those cars, I gotta admit one thing. The engineering involved those automobiles certainly had a lot to do with the beginning of aerodynamics. And I figured we'd have to do a couple aerodynamic automobiles. Ralph Roberts would take one of the cars. And Ralph would do the Golden Arrow. And I would do the Thunderbolt. And I thought that Ralph didn't quite know what he wanted to build. And I said, why don't you do a double cowl tail? And, like Gordon Buick would do as an example. And he thought it'd be a pretty good idea. So we gave him a couple models. So we decided to go into scale models. Quarter side. Now Chrysler, unfortunately, they had done a wonderful masterful job as far as the weight balance on automobiles. They moved the engine forward some 18 inches. However, the cars had a very ugly look. They looked like they were just the hoods were nondescript. They were very short and bulbous looking. The car suffered from a strange disease called interchangeabilitis, where the left door in the front could be rotated and could become the rear on the right side and reversing the same process. And this was a matter of getting the tooling costs of the automobile down real low. The car, unfortunately, went over there. The public didn't accept the car at all. And, regarded as the air flop. That was a terrible thing to say about an automobile, but the whole motoring world regarded it as the air flop. Rear passengers were very fortunate. They sat ahead of the rear axle. Their advertising was very dramatic, such as a lady sitting in the back seat of the DeSoto and merely just stating, I am writing this letter, riding in a DeSoto Airflew aerodynamic coupe at 80 miles an hour. And that now meant, here's a new approach to an automobile, a very wonderful, fantastic ride. So what I was trying to do was to absolve Chrysler of having built an automobile called the Airflow. And certainly did have some intelligent aerodynamics, but it wasn't as streamlined as they thought it would be, because it had a coefficient of drag of 0.51, which is basically, if you took one square foot of a piece of cardboard, and let's say this car supposedly has an index number of 0.50, you just cut it in half. That means that 50% of it, instead of it being sticking your hand up, you can feel the air drag, and that's a flat plate air, 60 miles an hour. Every all of us do that. People, kids in cars. I used to make airplane propellers as a kid, and you just stick it out the side of the car, so the propeller would go in the wind with you. And that there was a car called the Lincoln Zephyr. That was an automobile that really had superb aerodynamics. While its chassis was not as exotic as the original Chrysler Airflow, Airflop, or whatever you want to call it, it was 5% lower in air drag. And the Lincoln Zephyr was a masterpiece. But now, the very mention of an aerodynamic automobile was nothing like anybody and everybody. That we would have to just simply, we figured that Lincoln Zephyr had a fantastic jump. They had really broken the ice, very beautiful automobile. And they should continue. And Chrysler was so terrified at the horrible reception of the public there that they decided to literally ignore it with statements such as, no, we've got to get back to a conventional look to an automobile. And let's not get caught in any more fiascos. Finally, however, Dave Wallace was president, or vice president of Chrysler Corporation, and K.T. Keller were smarting under this image of the Airflow, and he says, can you build a car like this in 90 days or so? I assured him that we could, and K.T. Keller was very much interested in how we arrived at the name Thunderbird. He said, we got to get clearance for it, and he said, how do I get a hold of George Easton? I said, I don't know. And after all, this is my first transatlantic call that I ever had. And I said, why don't you just call the Autocar magazine? They're the only ones that can address the telephone number. She did. We finally got a hold. And they listened in on the phone also. And George Easton said, well, why are you calling this car that you're talking about the Skipper and Stones Thunderbird? And I said, because it's, I think it's a great step in the aerodynamics of any automobile that's capable of speeds of 250 miles an hour or 300 miles an hour can be labeled as an aerodynamic masterpiece. And in those days, it was really funny. All the Chrysler executives wore their hats. J.T. Keller always had his hat on. And it was as if they had to put a fire out, and the first thing they would do in slow motion, the best way to describe it, would be to get up off the desk, take a few steps, go over, grab your hat, put it down, and run out into the shop. This means there's an emergency, something's happened to the production line, you've got to go out there and stop it. The only way to do it is to have that hat up. That gives you a certain amount of authority. They finally decided to give us a crack, and but they didn't think they could build a Thunderbolt because it had a curved windshield. And there was no way we knew how to curve glass in those days. This was 1939-1940. However, the chief body engineer, Mr. Voltifer, sort of came to my aid and said, "We can't put this up with your cars. I said, "Yeah, I know it. Look, let's try it and see what happens. And I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll settle for a V-shaped windshield. And I'll just give me a V, flat glass." And they said, "Oh, we can do it." So that's how the Thunderbolt was settled. I went to the auto shows. I had to take it to New York, both cars. I had two Golden Arrows that I was going to, they were actually plated in gold. And the one thing I didn't like on the Chrysler products, KT Fellows said, "Now where's our badge?" And to me it looked like a cookie in those days, the Chrysler identification. He said, "How are they going to know what kind of a car this is?" This is Thunderbolt, ultimate expression. Chrysler's philosophy. This car is unmistakably aerodynamic. It started a new trend. Didn't have four fenders like General Motors cars did. In fact, the first car Harvey Earl built had was called the wide job.
Mr. Tremulous, we have to just stop for a second and change the tape.
Okay.
And then the fit. Yes. Just a second.
Sure.
It's really excellent what
These
you're telling
really
us.
Well,
it's going to be so valuable to have this.
Stuff out and smooth it out too.
Another thing to hold for a second. There was a sign, and it was called the Newport.
Mm-hmm.
And I figured, let's have it here. So I said, "Here, I got two Golden Arrows here." And Ralph Roberts said, "Hey, that's wonderful. Let me have one of them."
Oh, he did take one.
Yeah,
you said,
he took one.
At one point, you said you
Somebody
put it back in your suitcase.
One. Yeah.
But they disappeared. Did not
they
see
disappeared,
them.
Yeah. I would have loved to have that. Philosophy I always do. Not
Well, Mr. Tremulous, would you tell us in a kind of self-contained statement about what you think the overall effect of the failure of the airflow was on advanced styling?
It was very unfortunate because really, the Chrysler Airflow did have a different philosophy. And years later, you can look at the car and say, it really wasn't as bad as but however, the top management at Chrysler just arrived at the final conclusion that people will never buy aerodynamic automobiles. And we've got to make our cars a little bit more conservative and forget these fast tails in the back. And let's get the hoods to look like a hood should look like a narrow lacelle and work from there. And it set us back these 10 years. This plan is only 30 years old. And all of a sudden, we're now talking about what happened in the last 1,700 years. The automobile was designed, people talked about it, 100 years ago. And what happened before the 19th century? It was absolutely staggering. At the time, you go back to the Stone Age, practically, Cro-Magnon man. And all of a sudden, thousands, if not millions of years of absolute stagnation, where the wheel, thank God the Romans and the Egyptians, invented the wheel. That was the start. And then all of a sudden, we accelerate our thinking, and the last 1,700 years we've gone from horseless carriages to automobiles.
And would you tell us what you think the effect of experimenting with aircraft technology has had and should have on automobiles?
I remember the time when an automobile, one two-cylinder, called a London, bicycle wheels, practically wire wheels, very thin tires, people sitting very high in the open. And then I take a look at the airport. And it seemed to me there would have to be a happy marriage between aircraft technology and automobile. There was a time when at the county fairs, they would have an aeroplane or a white balloon racing an automobile. And the automobile always won. It was 9 times out of 10. The aeroplane was had a certain stigma. I find it difficult to believe that when the parachutes were first invented for aeroplanes, that you would die. It used to be 1, 2, 3, and you pulled the ripcord. If you went to 10, you would die, because man was not designed to land at speeds of 110, 120 miles an hour. There had to be something done to narrow the gap. Unfortunately, it took a war to suddenly start accelerating the progress of the airplane. The airplane to me, when I was in high school, was very influential to my thinking. And I was studying aerodynamics with Paul Lahan. And one day, Mr. Lahan came over, and he had a World War I Jenny airplane that we used to practice. We would take the wires either off and then put them back on again. We'd have a new crew of students. And I thought that the wires, I was told to take a couple of the fellows out there and take all these wires off. And I said, but they're so heavy. How's this airplane going to fly? He said, you get it? He says, if we can eliminate the drag of these wires are streamlined, which means different. You can pick up 5 miles an hour. So then I decided to, what would happen if just streamlining a wire from a round wire to a streamlined shape with a tapering tail, in spite of the weight, for performance, what's going to happen when we eliminate the wires? Oh, that'll never come. We're working on it. And finally, I asked, could I make a model? The wire is that streamlined, can I make a model of an automobile? And that model I have over there, it's a good size model. It's really odd because it's talking about what I was thinking about many, many years ago. And that was really, as far as I was concerned, I decided to pick a Duesenberg. So I picked a Duesenberg model, or made one for my graduation, and took it to the Duesenberg sales room. During the auto show, they put it on the on the table. And it was timed just perfectly because Paracero had just come out with one of the most fantastic audio at that time. Oh, the Air Force to me, you know, I say, my view is I spend at the Air Force. See, I love to go back. It's possible. There's no way. But, it was really funny. I was drafted. Anyway, I got in and I had prepared myself. I really wanted to be an aircraft or something. I'd made a series of drawings. Put them in the mail and just sent it to I sent it to the Pentagon, the aircraft technology. Somehow or other, by that time, I was now a buck private because now I signed up for 3 years, but I had no idea what was going to happen in the aircraft. And then all of a sudden, I bolt of lightning. General Hap Arnold, Chief of the Air Force, the digital press, and to get that guy and send him the right field. Okay, put me in an airplane and take me to the right field. Right field people say, there's nothing we can do with this guy. If you want him, you've got to send him to the officer's candidates. And we don't have time for that. So I wound up as only but private at right field. It was really funny because out of building 125 and everybody, all the officers were there, but now it was reduced to officer person. Officer personnel.
Sure, you can start.
And civilian personnel, yeah. You had to be civil service. So I reported to Wright Field Aircraft Laboratory. I remember that they knew the best. Colonel Paul Cameron, Chief of the Aircraft Laboratory. Very good. He looked at my drawing and he said, I cannot authorize an expenditure of $360 a year to make pretty pictures of airplanes. So I knew that he was sort of upset with me. He said, I've got to go to the Pentagon. I'll be back maybe in a week, maybe 10 days, and I'll see what I have to do. So as he walked out with prints that were about 2 foot high, that were typical in the core and ropes, pick up the two sets of prints, a lot of people get down to the Pentagon. I said, what's the colonel doing? Oh, the colonel's got an arrow, talking to 200,000 pound bomber. And what's it look like? Well, we don't know. All we got is prints. It's pieces, you know, gun turrets. That's no way to sell an airplane. So you got to pretend it's an automobile. We have brochures. Now I asked for a drawing table. And sure enough, we have drawing table. They gave me one. So what are you going to do? I said, I need some air. And I was, what for? It's an airbrush. I'm going to make airbrush friendly. And before long, I took his airplane, bits and pieces, and showed him what the airplane looked like. Right? What it looked like when the bomb bay doors were open, how many bombs were in there, and what was its range. Here's a chart with a nice little delineation that this airplane taking off to find a 50-foot obstacle. And Colonel Kemmer comes back and I said, how'd you make out when you were with the Pentagon? And he says, terrible. These idiots just don't understand. They don't even know how to read a print. Half of them look at a print upside down and shake their heads and say, looks great, and then they're wrong. this tells a picture. So now Colonel Kimball looked at it, jumping a piece of train, but the mail train, he was always saving money for flying the mail for the field back. And finally, he came in, I opened up the this brochure, page one, page two, standard covers, just got on this mail train. Down the mail train, down there, General Ali Ecker, who's deputy chief of the world. Right? And he says, "Paul, what are you doing here?" He said, "You just, we've given you 8, 9 days. He said, "Well, wait a minute, wait till you see what I've got." So he introduced him to the general, and I opened up one page after the other, 10 reviews, Remy, 12. And he said, "God, now this is what we need. This makes a lot of sense." So then he said, "I want this young man here, Tremulous, what's your name?" I said, "I have no name." He said, "Well, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it." Later on, I wound up, they promoted me very fast. He said, "I want you here. You're only going to get 20 minutes a month. And that 20 minutes, you're going to tell me what's going on at Wright Field and what laboratories, and I'm opening the door to all the laboratories." Now down there, I would look at the, we were just really getting stuff. We had 240, along came the illustrious P-51. And just to show you how damn near lost a few of the P-51 airplanes. The philosophy and the thoughts of the product planners believed that it would be a duplication of effort to build this new airplane that's called the Apache, North Apache airplane, designed by North America. And when they looked at it, they said, "Here's two aeroplanes, P-51 and P-40. They have the same wing loading. That means the performance is limitless. They weigh the same. The engines developed all the aeroplanes." And it's ridiculous to think of spending additional funds on this P-51 aeroplane. Then one day, England gave them an order for 50 aeroplanes. General Arnold landed in England. He looked at all the crates of the P-40s. He said, "What are these P-40s doing in these crates?" And he said, "The Royal Air Force doesn't like them, and our pilots over there want to be the North American Apache." And he said, "Why? In spite of the fact that while they look like duplication, it just happened that the North American P-51 50 miles an hour faster."
Mr. Tremulous, I wanted to just, there's so much ground we have to cover. You've done so much and are still doing so much that I wanted to ask you if you would talk a little bit about the Tucker, about if you would explain to us, tell us about your experience in designing the Tucker and describe the Tucker for us.
Well, the Tucker automobile.
Just stop for a second here.
See if you hear any orange. Could be the battery.
I just hear the rustling.
Okay, could you stand up for a minute? Mm-hmm. Second one. Yeah.
Thank you.
Are you comfortable so far?
Yeah.
Good.
I think I'm over talking.
No, I think you're fine. Would you stand up for that?
Oh, sure.
Very, very momentary, kind of almost a blip.
Was there?
Wireless, you never know. It could be somebody on a, somebody out there on a CD or.
Mm-hmm. Right. Better safe than sorry.
Is that the slide thing, honey? And you thought that? I hear some click, 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 click. Is it one of those rotary slide?
Putting in a fresh cartridge of tape.
Shouldn't. Somebody usually somebody's using a radio or a telephone or something.
Excuse me. Do either of you like a sip of water? Are you okay? For your voice? Would you like a sip of water for your voice? Are you okay?
Oh, no. Oh, Martina, Manhattan.
Are you comfortable?
Yeah.
You seem very comfortable.
Yeah.
Right?
Very relaxed, yeah.
I'm disgusted with myself. I figure, how come I'm shifting gears all the time?
Oh, no. No, it's just unfolding in such a natural way. It's wonderful.
We're the ones who are shifting gears.
That's right. I have the gears in my head shifting from one thing to the next.
I became very excited when I heard the wrong thing about you all the way over there. I'm a drawing. And from the publicity, it was an evil. After all, the deal was practically 80 or 90% designers. And then I started hearing some funny grumblings about Tucker Auto being a problem with people. At that time I was working at St. Louis General School, other schools, parent schools. And went through a very hot seas weather. Very warm, 100 degrees, and up to St. Louis is gone. Maybe I ought to take a crack and see what's going on in Chicago. So I made a call to Preston Tucker and said that I got some drawings here to show you preliminary that Tucker automobile should look like. And at least I'd like to have you take a look at these drawings. So he said, I'm very, very busy. He says, you bring the drawings down, and I'll take a look at them, and I'll give you 15 minutes. And I said, that's all we're going to do. I got really surprised about that all the taking to me. Following Fred Rockman and all the vice presidents. So it was a good start. George Lawson was the first designer. George Lawson was one of the most talented designers I've ever met. As far as being a wild designer, that's what I always tried to be and what I really thought all of us should be, and accelerate and slow down. Finally decided to hire me as a consultant. Poor George Lawson, but I know that. I think George and I were made a tremendous team because we both worked together at the Baron. We designers always rubbed off on each other. If I could do an automobile, so this is the first election we do. What GM would do, and this is what I want to do, and this is what everybody should do. But at Tucker Corporation, I got down there, and I was quite shocked and surprised to find all they had is full size drilling in water. They were working in overcoats and cold. And I was introduced to some of the men at Preston Tucker Hire, and Preston Tucker Hire, anybody who had anything to do with Indianapolis with the star, which is the hire of the best mechanics. We hired people like Herman Ringley, who father felt the maestro when he came to building automobile body metal. Now it looked like we'd have a car and on the right track. I had a little bit more production car experience than George Lawson. And the George Lawson car, I think, was a beautiful thing. The only thing wrong with it was that it was a four-passenger automobile. The rear seats could only be filled by 2 8- or 9-year-old kids. Really wanted production automobile to carry 6 people. So that was the only car that started it. Great affection, and we referred to it as a Tim Goose. To this day, the very fact that I'm christened with that name, as I did, is a great feeling of respect and affection for the Ford Tri-Motor. That was also a part of Tim Goose. And that was the beginning of the Tucker automobile. Wanting a clay model, let's just cut this. Nope, you're going to build it out of metal. I said, well, there's no way I can build it out of clay model, and we'll have to do it. And then the metal car can come along. He said, no, I'll give you 60 days to build it. Well, we worked 140 hours a week. We didn't know whether it was Friday, Sunday, or whatever. 16 hours a day, 18 hours a day sometimes. That's okay. We got the car out in 1 week. But it was the beginning. From there, we started full-size drafts and the die models. We got the start of the die models. And we were doing this. 15 or 20 people. Eventually, at one time, when we really were getting close to the production, we had approximately 100 people, full-size layout. We were tooling by working and taking all the templates off the Tim Goose. I was a little disappointed in the engine. Tucker 550. The 589 cubic inches. Always expensive. I don't remember that. There. But anyway, the 589 engine on paper was a real masterpiece. It meant that here's an engine that I would want to get out. And at 500 RPMs, the engine cranking about 150 horsepower. And it's developing at maximum, which is 130 miles an hour. The question is very generous for horsepower when you talk about it. Unfortunately, on paper, it was a masterpiece. It meant that here's a lifetime engine. The maximum speed will only be turning 1,300 revolutions per minute. This engine will last forever. And it has, we've eliminated the camshaft, the valve train, is going to be hydraulically actuated. That's why the engine upgrade is so slow. And occasionally a line would break. When a prominent newspaper man came and visited the Tucker Corporation, he one of the oil lines broke and destroyed a very beautiful seat. And as the girls and people walking around, there was a colonel who was at the head of the Tribune newspaper.
McCormick.
Yes. Colonel McCormick. And once this incident hit the press, the paper, it looked like this might be the beginning of the end of the audience. Somehow or other, though, he did survive. I never had faith in that because you know, they were too sophisticated for the time. Low RPM engines. And the torque inverters that Preston Tucker was talking about, the engine was placed directly over the gear. The torque inverter in each hand, each rear wheel, probably operated the torque inverter. And when it came to building the car, I figured I'd better fix this thing. This is going to be. Fortunately, I had experience with all these abilities. This car really needs is solve all the transmission problems by using the Ford transmission to marry the Ford transmission to any kind of a V8 engine or whatever you want, a flat engine. You can arrange a happy marriage in that area. And if so, the engine will be back. And thank God this new engine that just shown an interest in was the Franklin Syracuse. And designed by Carl Doman, one of the world authorities of air cooling engines. He said, Alex, we've gone through 4 years of work with air cooled engines. And the engines we're building today are far superior to the engines we were building in air cooled. It's a matter of 4 or 5 years ago. And fortunately, in order to get Carl Doman, get the engine, we just brought in Carl Doman. We hired him as chief engineer, let him have the ball and run with it. And as it happened, we were able to get that engine in there. We still had 3 or 4 inches in clearance. But the car was also was getting awfully close to production. We got so close to production that it was just a question of if we can just last another 30 days. Now we have to hire 2,000 people to get started, and that's going to double every month to 4,000, 6,000. Pretty soon we're going to be talking in terms of 20,000 employees. And unfortunately, the government's Securities and Exchange Commission really came in and dropped a hammer on all of this. And it was the beginning of the end. So it could have been an automobile. So many years ahead of its time, would have influenced the entire automobile industry. In fact, everybody, when they first saw it, the styling section of General Motors, they were looking out of the 14th floor. And absolutely went out of their mind. How on earth could we build a car so fast? And we went through $28 million. Today, it would cost, we talk in terms of the Ford, Sable, those are $2 billion operations. But it's unbelievable what the cost was then, what we could have made.
Would you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the exterior design of the car?
Yes, well, it had to be a streamlined automobile, right off the bat. When I showed Tucker some of my airplanes and all that, he said, for God's sake, don't look at them like this. Scared by an airplane. But it had to be aerodynamic. And in other words, I wanted the windows to be as close to the sheet metal instead of a very deep indentation in the windows. Wind blower, second parishioners. Had to carry six people, and Fred Rockelman had came in one day. He was vice president. Came in with something that looked like a flying saucer, and he went like this, and it turned out to be one of these topsail caps. He put that thing on, and said, "Well, this looks pretty good. We could still get another inch." And then the president said, "No, wait a minute. We're not going to the opera, so we don't need these opera caps." In fact, the women in those days had hats with peasant tails on them. And when you slam the door on it, you're the thing sticking outside. And, but we were the first to come up with doors that opened up into the room. Another thing we had to contend with, we had designed that automobile with this frame to a point where we had Chicago curbs done, we all had to respect the height to get out of the building. And this was in the day when we did everything possible to give the car the lowest center of gravity. We were the first with the wide track automobiles. We had the audacity to go from 56 inches to 63 inches. No, in the front, and 65 inches in the rear. We hired dramatically rolling automobiles over, in which they would build a ramp and they would try and get the car to land on its side and also on its roof. Lucky Teeter was the man's name. That was Lucky Teeter, because he'd survived all these crashes. And Lucky said, "Look, I know you guys went to pay me $1,500 for rolling this thing over, but there's no way I can roll this thing over. This automobile has got the lowest center of gravity of any engine, you just simply can't roll it over." And he said, "You don't owe me anything." But he said, "I'm not about to try and roll over an automobile. It doesn't want to roll over, and you wouldn't even know how to roll over." So that was it. So we knew we had the safest car. And I didn't even trust what I was trying to do. There was a young man that came in looking for a job. He was a North American engineer. I had a lot of respect for him, but the design was just a redesign, killed. B-40, that same airplane, P-51, and you take air in and make sure that no blisters on the fuselage for the first 50-60%, very smooth. Then at the bottom, they had a sort of they call it an aerodynamic belt or whatever. They could take air in at 400 miles an hour, and it would be heated to 450 miles an hour. And they were the first, and we were the first. Poor man's just a passion.
I was going to ask if you would tell us a little bit about your relationship with, we're out of tape? Okay, we're just about to run out of this tape, so we'll put another one in.
Okay.